Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Edward Ball is a writer who is best known for a book he wrote 15 years or so ago called Slaves in the Family, where he traced his own family's slaveholding history and actually went so far as to track down descendants of slaves that his ancestors had owned, completely changing the conversation about slavery and about its legacy in the United States and making it a much more personal thing. You may have heard of that book, and that's not going to be completely our focus today, though it certainly is going to come into it. The reason I particularly wanted to speak with Edward Ball is because I happened to read an article that he'd written recently, I think it was last fall, for Smithsonian Magazine. If you've never read Smithsonian, I highly recommend it. It's put out by the Smithsonian. It has wonderful, wonderful articles about American history. And this one was about something that Edward Ball calls the slave Trail of Tears. Now, you might be a little confused by that at first. You're thinking Trail of Tears, oh, that was the American Indians, the Native Americans who were forcibly removed from the East and sent out to places like reservations in Oklahoma. Well, that's true. That's what we typically use when we talk about what we're talking about when we talk about the Trail of Tears. But there was a very similar Trail of Tears for American slaves, one that was actually much more long-lasting and involved many, many more people over many, many more years, that started on the East Coast, notably in Virginia, which had a surplus of slaves, especially after slave trading was stopped over the Atlantic, and then extended from the eastern part of Virginia across that state into Tennessee and Kentucky and other places, sometimes diverging off to the Ohio or Mississippi rivers, other times going overland toward the Deep South, where there was a shortage of slave labor. It was a vast internal forced migration of American slaves, many of whom were sold with their families broken up. It's just something that most of us aren't that much aware of. Certainly, I was not as much aware of it as I should be until I read this article and was stunned to see that many places that I visited, many places near where I live, were stops along this Trail of Tears. Here's Edward Ball.
I'm a writer of nonfiction. I've published 5 books of history and biography, most of them about the Deep South. And that's what I do.
And you're associated somehow with Yale University, because I noticed that in your address.
That's right. I have taught at Yale part-time, writing classes, occasionally a history class. And I teach one course per semester.
I see. Well, a very interesting pedigree and lots of books. Of course, the one that caught my attention some time ago was your 1998 book, Slaves in the Family, where you discussed your own personal connection to slavery, which would no doubt justify an entire hour-long episode of this show. But more specifically, my attention was drawn to you because you followed that up with an article in Smithsonian Magazine. I believe it was last November. About the so-called Slave Trail of Tears. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Right. In the 50 years before the Civil War, about 800 or 900,000 enslaved people were deported, if you like, from Virginia and Maryland down to Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama to work in the booming cotton plantations of the Deep South. And this is a story that I think is not well known. We know about the Trail of Tears in the 1830s when Creek Indians were forced to march west out of Alabama and Georgia to Oklahoma to take up residence in newly made reservations there. But this rather similar kind of anguished human transport is not well known. I tried to retell the story of the movement of nearly a million black people against their will, overland in most cases, marching from Virginia through Tennessee, down through northern Mississippi to New Orleans, I tried to retell that story by retracing the path that gangs of slaves were made to march from Alexandria, Virginia, which is outside of Washington, D.C., all the way to New Orleans. And that's what this piece was about. That you
And you tell the story very compellingly. It's a very sad tale. It's a very gripping tale. A very uncomfortable tale, especially for somebody like me who used to live in Alexandria and who now lives near another town that you mention along this trail, Abingdon, Virginia.
And oh, really?
And yes, yeah. And who has been to many of the places in between over the last few decades. And it certainly puts them in a different light. But before we get to that, and I do want to hear about it and in all of its grisly detail, why was this happening? Why was this migration, this forced migration, I should say, this deportation, why was it happening from Virginia down to these other parts of the country?
Mm-hmm. Well, the old plantations of the eastern seaboard, the tobacco plantations of Virginia and Maryland and the rice plantations of South Carolina and Georgia, and were about 100 years old by the time of the war between the states, by 1815. And the boom economy that we associate principally with the South, which is to say the cotton plantations, when we think of slavery, we usually think cotton. This was yet to arise, and cotton planting boomed after 1815 in the new states, the new territories of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, which were largely cleared for the invasion by white people, cleared of Native Americans by Andrew Jackson and people like that. And when cotton took off, many Virginia slave owners and Carolina slave owners decided they would sell people that they'd known for their whole lives to the new entrepreneurs of cotton planting. And so this mass migration, this forced relocation was a matter of slaveholders in the East selling people for money to new slaveholders in the Deep South and forcing people to leave. And the typical outcome was that families were broken apart and children were taken at age 9, 10 from their parents and wives were taken from their husbands and sent to slave markets in New Orleans to be sold to the highest bidder. And that's the story that's very much in the closet and as
sure
one of many dark chapters in our Southern history.
As distasteful as it is, then we simply have to acknowledge that what this was is that we have to acknowledge that slavery, the slaves themselves were right up there with land as being among the biggest economic assets in the United States, and that there was, in some sense, a surplus of this asset in the older plantations along the seaboard, because, of course, human beings reproduce. And there was a deficit. There was an increasing need for this asset, for this human labor in these newer territories. And so it was essentially the flow of these assets, these human assets, from, as you say, all the way in the eastern seaboard in Alexandria, which is right on the eastern seaboard, basically, into the interior. And as you point out, these are people who are selling other people they've known all their lives. So it starts out in a particularly unpleasant way. But could you go ahead and trace it more or less as you did in your article? What happened? The decision was made at individual plantations, and typically, I'm guessing, just for straight economic reasons? To sell slaves?
Yeah. So the example I focused on in this piece was a guy called William Waller.
Right.
Who is a small slaveholder in central Virginia who was in debt to his brother-in-law. He enslaved perhaps 12 or I think it was more than that. I think it was 16 people. And he and his wife, Waller and his wife, and the people that he enslaved were ranging from age 5 to, 65. And he and his wife decided, we no longer want to be in this tobacco business, and we're deeply in debt. Let's sell everybody. And so Waller, in, I think it was 1834, decided to go on a forced march with his enslaved workers and two or three other men, armed men, across the South to Natchez, Mississippi, which was one of the big slave markets. This is a 1,000-mile march. And so they set out. And typically, the gangs who were force marched were called coffles, C-O-F-F-L-E-S.
I've never heard that word before. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I don't know where it comes from. But it's a word that dates from the African slave trade.
Ah.
When coffles, I think the word is taken from West Africa. I'm not certain of this. You know, we all think about slavery as coming, slave trade as something that happened from Africa to the Americas. And it did, of course. 12 million people were taken from West Africa and put on ships and chains brought to the Americas. But in the United States, that traffic in people ended in 1808. And nevertheless, agriculture and money-making determined that the buying and selling of people had to continue. And so after 1808, when Congress banned the international slave trade, a domestic slave trade arose to take its place. And this is what we're talking about now. And far more people in the United States were sold in the domestic slave trade than were ever sold by the international slave traffickers.
That's another thing you taught me. I had not realized how extensive the domestic slave trade was.
Yes, millions of transactions. It was a roaring business, and there were slave trading firms all over the South and in the capital in Washington, D.C. And we are more familiar from the film 12 Years a Slave with this traffic than we were 2 years ago. So William Waller sets out, and he marches with his coffle of enslaved workers in chains. The chains were, the coffles were marched in single file or double file with a chain running from person to person, locking to a clasp on their wrists, so that if one tried to flee, everybody would be pulled to the ground. And they set out, and they marched about 25 miles a day for months, and arrived finally in Natchez, Mississippi.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Edward Ball, not about his famous book, Slaves in the Family, where he examined his own family's slaveholding past, but about a more recent article he wrote for Smithsonian Magazine, where he talked about something I was really only vaguely aware of, the slave Trail of Tears. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Edward Ball. Stick around.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans.
So
once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz featuring the quiz guy, the director of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, Douglas Smith.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
Fine. You know, there's an old saying that the longer your title, the less important you are. And you've got one of the longest titles of anybody I know.
It's very true, both of those.
It's a true thing. Okay,
yes,
tremendous. Well, we're very happy to have you here. See, on our show, you're just the quiz guy.
Yeah.
Which means you're really important.
I overcompensate on my business card.
You do, okay. Tremendous. Do we have any contestant for the quiz guy today?
Hello.
Well, who are you, sir?
Hi, my name's Chad. I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Chad from Charlottesville, Virginia. What do you do in Charlottesville, Virginia, Chad?
I'm a law student at UVA.
At the University of Virginia. I have heard of that law school, and that is a fine, fine place. Well, I'm just so pleased to have you because, of course, a number of law students listen to us. And I have to ask you this. Does listening to our show help you with your studies?
I think it definitely does. I often listen to it driving home from the library, so I definitely have a joy listening to it.
Well, tremendous. Of course, this is not, strictly speaking, a lecture class or a law class, but it's from time to time occurred to me that this is something that if I'd been in law school, I think I would have found it very helpful, especially with con law, but, you know, with a lot of the other legal concepts we have. So that's very good. I'm very gratified to hear that. And are you ready to do a quiz?
I am.
Okay. This is a law student from a fine, fine law school, Doug. So let's give him the hardest quiz you have.
Well, you know, I'm going to assume that Chad wants someday to be in the Supreme Court, so I'm going to ask a Supreme Court question.
Do you want to be in the Supreme Court, Chad?
You know, if the opportunity comes, I think I'd have to consider it.
Okay, tremendous.
You have to consider
it. You have to consider it.
Something Congress currently is not willing to do.
But that's true enough, too.
Okay, Chad, here comes the question, and I'll give you four choices.
Got it.
What profession does the U.S. Constitution bar from being a Supreme Court justice? What profession does the U.S. Constitution bar from being a Supreme Court justice? Is it A member of the clergy, B, former president of the United States, C, a foreign-born governor, potentially named Schwarzenegger, or D, none of the above?
So you're saying that Article 3, or the Constitution, might ban a particular profession.
Is it A, a member of the clergy, B, a former president of the United States, C, a foreign-born governor, because you can't be a foreign-born president,
right?
Or D, none of the above?
Got it. Well, the answer, I believe, is D.
None of the above?
That's what I'm going to go with. It certainly can't be B, and I don't think we've had a member of the clergy, though we might have had a foreign-born governor, depending on, before the states were admitted. But I'm going to go with D.
Wait a second now. Before we do that, now you're sure? I mean, could we really have a member of the clergy? Wouldn't that violate the separation of church and state?
I don't think that would violate the Establishment Clause. No.
And you think we could have a foreign-born person in there? We can't have one as president, but we could have one on the court?
I think so, yeah. I definitely don't remember any bans on professions for the Supreme Court.
I don't think I can budge him on this one, Doug.
Well, for good reason. He's at the universities.
He's at the university. So they learn him good there at UVA.
D is correct.
D is correct. Well done.
There's actually no qualifications for being on the Supreme Court.
Uh-huh.
So, which is kind of interesting. In fact, there have been foreign-born justices like Felix Frankfurter.
Felix Frankfurter, a big one, a giant on the court.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, big. And so there's no really age layout.
Right.
There's no kind of birth layout. It's not like president at all.
Right. And they certainly have not all been judges. Some of them have come from different walks of life. And in fact, one of the great giants of the 20th century, though he was a lawyer, had never even gone to law school.
It was James.
Robert Jackson is what I was thinking of.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of James Burns.
Yeah, well, that may... Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying that there's no technical qualification. You have to be a member of a bar or even a lawyer.
James Burns didn't even graduate from high school.
That is remarkable.
He worked as a law clerk and later read and passed the bar exam.
Remarkable fellow.
Became a Supreme Court justice.
Well, Chad, you got it right, and you got it right for exactly the right reason. You remembered Article 3 and that there were no particular qualifications for it. So not only do you get your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, but you get a T-shirt And all you need to do is send me an email at ywc@montpelier.org and send me your T-shirt size and your address, and we will have one in the mail to you.
Got it. My con law professor will be proud. Thanks for having me on.
Who is your con law professor?
Thomas Nockbar.
Well, say hello to Thomas for us. And
I will.
And suggest that he put us on his syllabus, and then all of your fellow classmates at UVA can be just as smart as you are.
That sounds like a great plan.
All right. Thanks very much, Chad.
Have a good day.
And thank you, Doug.
You bet, Stuart. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
And now it's time to continue our discussion with Edward Ball, most famously the author of a book called Slaves in the Family, and more recently the author of an article in Smithsonian Magazine about something he calls the Slave Trail of Tears. It turns out that there was an enormous forced migration of slaves from the eastern seaboard, notably in the eastern part of the Commonwealth of Virginia, to the west and to the deep south, where there was a need for additional slaves. And as these slaves marched across the Commonwealth and across several other states, they marched in chains.
And as they marched, the reason I know about this particular trip is William Waller wrote letters home to his wife back in Virginia. Every 2 or 3 weeks, he would say, you know, well, Sally, she's a little sick, and her daughter, her two-year-old, is at the breast, but doesn't look like she's going to survive. And the next 2 weeks would pass, and he says, George tried to run off today, but we got him back. And so I could sort of pinpoint the towns where they went and the route that they took, and a little bit about the people who were on the march. And that's what I did. And
excuse me for interrupting, a question about methodology. Where did you find these letters?
In the Virginia Historical Society in Richmond, Virginia.
And you just, were you looking for them in particular, or did you just come across them?
I just came across them, that's right. Yeah, I was looking for papers about the slave trade. There are papers that survived from, you know, 10 or 15 slave trading firms that were in business and careful enough to keep records that were not later burned or intentionally disposed of. You know, I mean, by the end of the Civil War, slave trading was justifiably regarded as a venal and shameful business, and those who had done it were not necessarily keen to identify themselves as former traffickers in flesh. So not a lot of papers survive from slave trading companies, but the papers of this Waller family, who were not professional slave traders, but just a part of the Virginia elite, they survived as a small group of family papers, and within them were these letters I was describing.
Very compelling. And is that when you thought about actually making the trip yourself?
I was looking for some chronicle by the hand of somebody who had made this trip. Of the 800 to 900,000 people who made this trip, about half of them were marched overland like this, and the other half went by boat from Norfolk, Virginia, or Alexandria, or somewhere on the North Carolina coast, down around the tip of Florida, up to the Mississippi River, into the river mouth, and up to New Orleans. But I was trying to find some record that would help me to retrace the path, because I knew that it was a highway. It was a human highway. and I was trying to find some way. In this batch of letters allowed me to do it.
Yeah, and of course the perspective of Waller himself is compelling, and of the people who were with him. But one of the images that in your article that really stuck with me was when you described how people who simply lived there, white people who simply lived along the route, or black people who lived along the route, would just see these coffles being marched by.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of people are just marching by.
In chains.
What a sight.
Well, it's the origin of the chain gang, mm-hmm. which is an image of American Southern lore. When I was a child in the late 1960s in Louisiana and in Mississippi, it was not, even then, a terribly uncommon sight to see chained prisoners working on road projects. So chain gangs were part of the landscape, and the chain gang arises with the domestic slave trade. How do you transport 10 to 30 people from one place to another? You chain them together. And you herd them onto a boat, or you march them down the road.
Oh, my. Let's get back to Waller. More specifically. So he starts in Alexandria. He marches west. What are some of the places he sees in Virginia and beyond? What are some of the specific place names? Because, I remember how struck I was when you mentioned those place names.
Yeah. Waller walks up to the head of the Shenandoah Valley at the western border of Virginia, which is the beginning of a well-traveled route that goes from northwest to southwest Virginia. And he passes through a town called Abingdon. Uh-huh. And then he turns at the base of Virginia west, due west, and enters Tennessee. He passes through Knoxville. He passes around Nashville. He comes to south central Tennessee to enter northern Mississippi and sets foot onto the Natchez Trace, which is a 400-mile long former Indian path from what is now Nashville down to Natchez, Mississippi, which is a town 100 miles north of New Orleans on the Mississippi River.
Do you know that it was that? Every place you've mentioned is a place which I've been to and a place with which I have some sort of connection. And and every place that you mention has changed my perception. I remember the Natchez Trace as a very, very pretty highway.
Yes.
That people now travel on thinking it has some sort of historical significance, and isn't it lovely, and isn't the canopy of trees over it wonderful, and isn't it a wonderful winding highway through some beautiful areas? And I think probably the vast majority have no idea that one of the major reasons it was used was for these coffles of slaves to be taken in chains.
Yeah. That was one of the uses of the Natchez Trace. Mm-hmm. It was also a trading route for commodities from lumber to food to what have you. So it was a highway. Mm-hmm. It was a horse and foot highway for several hundred years. And as I mentioned, in the early 1800s, when the domestic slave trade ramped up, at that point it became the major highway for the slave trade from the upper south to the lower south. And
when Waller gets down to Natchez? What happens then?
He gets down to Natchez and he comes to a place where a lot of slave traders are operating outdoors. Natchez is next to New Orleans, the second largest slave market in the Deep South. And he meets these are guys who have, it's sort of like a campground where each operator has a shed and a shack where people are held in jails. And there's a kind of common field where all the shacks are arrayed around, and on the steps of their shacks, they're conducting sales pitches, trying to sell their human property to cotton planters. So if you can imagine a kind of fairground, that's the setting. He comes to this fairground, yeah. Mm-hmm,
please.
And he meets a couple of guys, and there are, you know, guys with shacks, and they're also sort of operators who are sort of buzzing in and trying to, you know, cut themselves in as freelance slave traders. And Waller meets one of these guys who says, "Hey, you don't have to deal with these other men here. They're going to take too big of a commission. I'm going to try to find you a buyer from my friends out east of here." And so Waller says, "Okay, commission will be less." And meanwhile, you know, his enslaved workers are exhausted. They are sick. They dread what has happened to them. They are terrified that they're going to be sold to the hands of a brutal overseer. And nevertheless, they have no means of resisting. And Waller sort of gives the job, if you like, to one of these independent operators. And then he takes one of his men, one of his young black men, who he thinks is going to bring the highest price. I forget the man's name. Let's say it was Tom. And he takes Tom with him to New Orleans, which is 100 miles away, and leaves everybody else in the hands of this operator. And he thinks in New Orleans he'll get a really good price for Tom. So that's what happens.
Well, what happens? Did he actually sell Tom? What happens to the rest of his people?
He does sell Tom. He sells everybody. And
so from his perspective, it's a successful transaction, a successful...
That's right, yeah. From his perspective, it's a successful transaction. He's done what he wants to do. However, he writes home to his wife saying, "Gosh, I did not get enough money for these people. I feel like I've been taken. I could have gotten $5,000 or $8,000 more." And so he writes this kind of self-pitying letter to his wife, which is astonishing in a way, because here's a man who's just condemned 15 people that he's known for their whole lives to an unknown fate. And in fact, their fate is unknown because the records are not good enough for me to determine where they went and to whom they were sold and what their lives turned out to be. But two of them might have been sold to a cotton planter in northern Louisiana. Four would have been sold to a sugar planter in southwest Louisiana. A mother may have been separated from her 8-year-old son and sold to two different buyers. I just don't know. But the outcome was not a good one.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Edward Ball about something he calls the Slave Trail of Tears, the route, the migration, the forced migration of thousands upon thousands of African-American slaves from the Eastern Seaboard to the Deep South. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Edward Ball. Please stay with us.
Went down to the River Jordan, where John baptized three. When I walked the devil in hell, says Johnny baptized me. I say, roll, Jordan, roll. Oh, now roll, Jordan, roll. My soul will rise to heaven, Lord, for the year, Jordan, roll. Well, some say John was a Baptist.
Some say.
In James Madison's time, he conceptualized the problem of factions. He took all of those interests and convictions we all have, saw that they divided us in groups, and that's what he called factions. Madison realized that the primary reason that popular governments were always unstable is human nature, that self-interest is more powerful than commitment to the greater good, and that knowledge is always limited by our own experiences. Those diverse ideas and interests lead to the formation of factions, and this natural tendency is most destructive in popular governments. Madison argues, there's no way to get rid of factions, but we can control their effects. Let's use faction to our advantage. If you have a large number of diverse factions, they'll actually counteract each other. Let's bring more voices into the picture, not fewer. Let's include more ideas, and we won't end up with a majority faction making all the decisions. The key to our strength is in our diversity. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with Edward Ball, the author of a recent magazine article in the Smithsonian Magazine about something he calls the Slave Trail of Tears, the trail that thousands upon thousands of African Americans followed from places like Eastern Virginia to places like New Orleans. And these families were frequently broken up, not just on the beginning of the Trail of Tears, but at the end as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So there'll be some families who survived in a reduced form on this forced march, and at the end they are in fact separated from one another once again. So,
in fact, there was one really compelling story about a mother who was trying to convince a slave owner or a slave buyer to take her child as well. And that didn't happen. Yeah. And so they basically dragged the mother and child apart, wailing.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's got to be the most compelling image that anyone can take away from a slave auction, is the, you know, physically separating mothers and children, or fathers and wives and husbands and all the family members. But there were lots of little details in there that I found compelling. For example, the fact that these people are on the road for months at a time. And then when they get there, they pull out the fresh clothing.
Right.
They've got their auction clothing. They're going to dress them up and wash them up and make them look as good as possible, like right before they sell their wares.
That's right, yes. They carried new clothing for 1,000 miles. And then finally, at the point of sale, people were made to bathe and to put on this new clothing so that it might raise their curb appeal in the eyes of buyers. Yeah. So it's a sad story. And what's hard to do is to get inside the lives of the people who experience this, both black and white, because it does seem so remote from us now. And yet it was as common a commerce as railroad traffic, and it's been, I think, intentionally forgotten.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, of course, having spent a lot of time in the South, I've seen lots and lots of Confederate memorials, and lots of big engravings and statues showing the brave Confederate soldiers defending home and hearth against the Yankee aggressors. I've seen lots of that, but I've rarely seen any reference at all to the slave trade. One notable example or exception is the old slave market in downtown Charleston, which the last time I was there, and it's been some years now, really wasn't emphasizing its slave history. I mean, there was a reference to it, the old slave market. But I don't. I think they were selling souvenirs or something there that had nothing to do with slavery. It was a sort of a tourist trap, if I recall correctly. I've rarely seen much that commemorates the slave trade, much certainly that it reconstructs it or attempts to interpret it. So I was struck by the fact that the site of the big field that you described in Natchez has gotten some commemoration recently. I believe it's called the Forks of the Road.
That's right, yeah. And just parenthetically, Charleston, South Carolina, which is one of my hometowns, is in that Slave Mart Museum that you refer to has actually been turned into a serious museum of the slave trade.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. It's been many years since I've been there.
Yes, right. But I know the version that you saw years ago, which was the version that operated during my own childhood.
You could buy balloons there or something. T-shirts,
right.
Yeah.
Yes. But no, there's quite a good capsule summary. It's in the warehouse of a former slave trading firm, and it's a small, 2,000 square foot loft space, if you like, but it's full of a quite serious sort of historical treatment of what went on there and in places like that. And it's for that alone, it is perhaps the only, if perhaps one of the only, if not the only. Serious treatments of the slave trade that we have anywhere in the South.
Right. Most of it's just been erased. There was a fellow by the name of Boxley, I believe, who lived in Natchez, who has made it his mission in life to commemorate the Forks of the Road. And it seems at least he's got a historical marker there now.
He does. His name is Sir Boxley.
Right.
He's about 70. Uh-huh. He was born and raised in Natchez, Mississippi. He's a black man. When he was a kid in Mississippi, he, like most African Americans, had to pick cotton to make a day's wage. He went off to California during much of his adult life, 50 years, and then returned to Natchez, I don't know, 15 or 18 years ago, and has made it his mission to try to clear a space in public memory for the experience of that nearly 1 million people that we've been talking about. Natchez did not used to have any acknowledgement of this place called Forks in the Road, which was the fairground where people were bought and sold. But Boxley has been very publicly promoting and retelling the story for more than a decade. He's an agitator, if you like, His work, I think, has helped the National Park Service come to the table and install some, and actually acquire. And the city of Natchez acquired a piece of that fairgrounds and has cleared it of its buildings and put up some kiosks and historical markers there. And there's more to be done because the scale of the memory is much larger than what is now there. But it's Boxley's efforts that have gotten that kind of process moving.
Well, we certainly appreciate his efforts, as we do yours. I was flipping through the online version of your article as we were just discussing Mr. Boxley there. And I was reminded of one other aspect of the slave trade that is often overlooked and represents yet another particularly dark corner of it. Could you describe the subset of slaves who were called fancy girls?
Fancy girls, yeah. Well, in New Orleans especially, there was a part of the market for enslaved people, which was for concubines, if you like. I guess sex slaves.
Yeah.
We could call them. And the euphemism made use of was fancy girls. And in the throughout the 1800s until the end of slavery in 1865, young women, typically aged 13 to 30, typically lighter-skinned young women, whose parents might have included a white man and a black woman, mulattas, in the old term, were selected to be sold to men who wanted to have concubines. And the fancy market is how it was called. And these women attracted higher prices than seamstresses and cooks and field hands. They attracted higher prices than male slaves, who were the second most expensive, young male slaves, the second most expensive human property. And so that's a tale that's been somewhat told, but I think is of interest to everybody because it was an open sex market that was tolerated and regarded as having some use value by Southern whites for many generations.
You quote from a reporter of that era, and I'll just read a very brief passage from your article describing a young woman. She was about 16 years old. Her name was Hermina. She was sold for $1,250 to one of the most lecherous-looking old brutes I ever set eyes on, the reporter noted. That's the equivalent of $35,000 today.
Mm-hmm.
That was the price of buying a 16-year-old girl.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that is a particularly compelling part of the tale. Though it's very difficult to establish gradations of degradation in the story. So I'll just recommend to everyone who's listening that they find that article. It's online now. It's called Google Smithsonian Magazine Slavery Trail of Tears, and you can get that article. But I don't want to leave here without giving you an opportunity to mention your book, which might actually benefit you if people go out and buy that. So why don't we plug that book very briefly? I know it's been out for, my gosh, close to 20 years now, but it's called Slaves in the Family. And this was a much earlier effort on your part that traced your own connection to slavery. Was that the genesis of your interest in the subject?
It was a time when I became interested in my Southern roots. I was about age 30 and living in New York City, working as a journalist, when I had the idea that I really should investigate a family story that I'd known my whole life, which was my father's family were large-scale slaveholders in South Carolina for 170 years. And the Ball family were rice planters who owned 12 plantations and enslaved close to 4,000 people over the period of that 170 years. And although I didn't know the numbers until I did some research, I'd known this story, and it's kind of a radioactive story for people who come from families like mine, because white people who are descended from slaveholders don't have a consensus about how to speak about it. And so the subject is avoided in most contexts. But I dove in and wrote this book, Slaves in the Family, which told the stories of the people in the big houses, in the Ball family plantation big houses, the master's houses, and the stories of the people in the cabins whom we had enslaved. And what was possibly unusual about this project was that I wanted to find Black families whose ancestors, our family, had once enslaved. And it was possible to do this because the records were good enough from Ball plantations. And so I found dozens and dozens of living Black families today who traced their roots to Ball plantations, and with their consent and approval, told their family stories from slavery to the present. So that's the book that you're talking about.
And that's still available, right?
It is, yeah.
Right.
Is.
So I imagine it'll be a little harder to find than a bookstore these days. It's been out for quite a while now, but I just was noticing it is available on Amazon for those who wish to purchase it, Slaves in the Family by Edward Ball. Well, you've illuminated some very dark corners of American history. And again, thank you for all of your efforts. Before we run out of time, may I ask, what's your current project? Something similar or something different?
I'm writing a book about Louisiana in the Reconstruction years, which is the period right after the Civil War, when the South was trying to come to terms with what it meant to have 4 million freed people, when Southern whites were trying to figure out, along with Southern blacks, how to live together. And so that's what I'm writing now. It's a book about Louisiana during Reconstruction.
So when are we going to be able to buy that one?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe 2 years. These things are very slow. It's sort of like making a roast beef, you know, it takes a long time.
Good food takes time. Well, Edward R. Ball, thank you very, very kindly for sharing this with us. And once again, I encourage everybody to see your article in the Smithsonian Magazine and also to buy your book, Slaves in the Family. And we'll give you a call in a couple of years and we'll check out the next book as well.
All right. Well, thank you then for the invitation.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Edward Ball for sharing this very disturbing tale with us, but one that I think you'll agree is one that all of us Americans, all of us, need to know about. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.